Welcome to the Holistic Matters podcast. We're here with Mark Blumenthal. It's a podcast designed to help you learn to be the you that nature intended. And with that as a theme, I can't think of a better person to be talking about our next topic on basically holistic living, lifestyle management, and even sustainable agriculture. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, John.
So, Mark, you have your roots, as many of us do, in the natural products industry. And that, if we look back into the 60s and 70s, and probably well beyond that and before that, the basic premise of that was really trying to pursue a holistic lifestyle approach to trying to stay as healthy as you can and to avoid, you know, the development of compromised health. And that's kind of why people lived a holistic way of living in the 60s and 70s, starting with the use of herbs and, mm-hmm. and even the early and first, if you will, organic farmers that we knew about. And vegetarians were all part of that. Let's sustain the globe, sustain my community, sustain my life, sustain my health, those kind of things. Is that fair? What's your perspective on the origin of the natural products industry to begin with, as broad as that is, in the broadest context that it could be defined?
Well, yeah, thanks for bringing up this conversation and for including me in it. I'm grateful for that. And from my own personal experience, I became a vegetarian in the spring of 1968 as I was graduating from college during the buildup for the Vietnam War and the draft. And it made I became more sensitized, as did many young men my age at the time, sensitized as to what is the meaning of life, what's the purpose, and what am I doing here?
Were you a Berkeley grad? Or?
I was I went to the University of Texas at Austin. I'm from Texas. I was not a Berkeley grad, no. But I'm from El Paso, Texas originally. I was raised on chili rellenos and good Mexican food.
Awesome.
And out in West Texas, and went to the University of Texas at Austin, which is a great school and was a hotbed of student activity back in the day. And to this day, Austin is still a culturally progressive, very progressive city. Yeah. Environmentally
right.
progressive city, very musically and culturally progressive
musical.
City.
You can definitely speak at the very least on lifestyle balance.
Exactly. Well, Austin's considered,
right?
We call ourselves the live music capital of the world. Even on a Sunday right. night, you can go out and find 10 to 30 live music venues in Austin. A lot going on.
Was it 6th Street?
Sixth Street, the old Pecan Street. Yeah. That used to be the center of a lot of stuff back in the 70s and 80s, but it's spread all over town, especially as the center of the city is getting more and more expensive. Yeah. Even back then, I became a vegetarian basically as a reaction against the Vietnam War. I was a political science and philosophy major back then, and was really interested in those kinds of, things about values and lifestyle and what do I believe in and those kind of things. And with no disrespect to anybody who served in Vietnam, my brother went to Vietnam and served, and I have a lot of respect for him. It wasn't my path, at least not at that time, anyway. And I became a vegetarian because I believed I wanted to sustain life on the planet in ways that were different than how I'd been raised and how the culture was supporting me. And I started going to health food stores, such as they were in 1968. Yeah. Now, the health food store of 68 compared to the natural food store of 2018, there's a 50-year difference, literally, and they were mainly, back then, pill shops with foods for special dietary use. So if you were a diabetic or somebody on a low-sodium diet, a place where if you wanted yogurt or whole wheat bread, that's where you went. You went to the health food store, basically, to find that kind of vitamin C. You couldn't find vitamin C in a drugstore. It was in a health food store. And I went in, and there was a whole wall of herbal teas, the old Select and Alveda brands, and, a lot of old folkloric literature about herbs and wild foods and that kind of thing. I just found it very fascinating and started getting into all this kind of stuff as a hobby and as a personal interest, and became expanding my vegetarian, but I got interested in herbal medicine and the fact that plants can be used as teas, capsules, extracts, etc., as medicines as well, which basically directed my life path and eventually my career in the herbal community and the herbal medicine research community internationally. So I was one of the lucky ones, cool. I think.
So I remember visiting Austin. One of the first few trips I ever made there was in the late 70s and early 80s, and going into a store in Austin that was kind of a food co-op. Today, what I would describe as what I think or thought was one of the precursors to Whole Foods or Trader Joe's. So it was kind of one step up from the classic health food store you're describing into kind of a co-op where people came together. They shared fruits, vegetables, other healthy foods, herbs, teas, and so on. And the first time I saw that any place in the country was in Austin.
Really?
Okay. And then the reason why I bring that up related to this discussion on holistic matters and holistic health is Austin, for me, always defined a place where you go for this overall healthy lifestyle, a balance on health, nutrition, and back to the concept of natural holistic foods, herbals, other components. So is that where you learned it? And across the country, is that where a lot of it started, or was it between Austin and, say, the Northwest of the U.S.? Or
I think Austin, like many of the college towns of the 60s and 70s, generated a lot of awareness about food and farm, what we call now farm-to-table agriculture. And so a lot of buying clubs happened where people started pooling resources and buying together to get quantity discounts. And those buying clubs started coalescing and started working out of storefronts, which became food co-ops.
Yeah.
And so Berkeley had a food co-op. Austin did. I'm sure they did it in Ann Arbor and or Madison and other places around town that were, you know, hotbeds of this kind of area of activity where people were looking for different ways of buying food, sharing production, and also increasing the quality of the food that they were accessing, both at the farm level, but also in how they accessed it through distribution. So, I mean, Austin is the birthplace of Whole Foods Market.
Yeah, right.
And it was actually, Whole Foods was actually a merger of two smaller natural food stores back in late 79, 1980. Right. So, and Austin had quite a few natural food stores back at that time, and as did many other communities around the country.
So it seems that the world now is just catching up to that time, right?
I mean, there's
a greater appreciation today for, again, holistic approaches to almost everything. Yeah. Again, you know, keeping the world, the globe, safe and clean and sustainable, to farming techniques that are becoming more and more popularized and in demand by consumers for that. I mean, it's an important concept, especially in the natural products industry or people who are interested in self-health care.
Yeah, and what's happened is, of course, that this idea of organic farming, which came out of organic gardening originally, and thanks to Rodale and J.R. Rodale and his institute, which developed ways of organic gardening and putting it on a larger scale so that some of these cleaner techniques of farming, pesticide-free and use of fertilizers and compost, etc., biological pest control, that this could be applied and developed successfully on a macro level, on a larger farm level of multiple acres, not necessarily in the form of monocultural farming, variety of different types of crops operating simultaneously and in a rational and a symbiotic way. Thanks to Rodale and others, in the last 40 years, maybe 50 years, organic farming and organic food production has become not only successful, but also mainstream. And, you know, I remember talking to a guy in Dallas, Texas, at a friend's wedding back in the 70s, I think it was, and he and his family owned a large vegetable produce distribution company. And I was talking about, well, why don't you carry, or do you carry organic? He says, no, that's just a fad. This is 40 years ago. It's just a fad. And I said, well, not really. He says, well, it's cost too much. I said, that's only because the economies of scale of appropriate distribution haven't reached a critical point yet. And they will at some point. And it has. And what's happening is the cost of organic produce, which is still higher in many cases, but it's getting more and more affordable to the average family. You have big retailers like Walmart who are using organic, just like Walmart going for solar panels. I mean, there's a big difference between solar panels and organic food, but in some ways, we're talking about the economic dynamics of economies of scale. And when when Walmart just started putting solar panels in and ordering them from China, it was a big hit for the Chinese industry, and they were able to reduce their costs, and it made it more affordable, that technology, for the average smaller business and for the average person. And so there's a benefit for everybody across the value chain and across the consumer spectrum. And so that's what's happened with organic food, and it's been growing at a rate of something like 12, 15, 20% a year. So this is huge growth, and the good news is this is all for the best interest of the health of everyone concerned, because eating foods with less pesticides or no pesticides and or other agricultural chemicals is better for not only the individual, but also better for the environment. And that's an important part of the conversation, because we have to look at the earth as a whole and look at it as a living organism, and we have to treat it in a way that is respectful and productive, and as many people are using the term these days, regenerative. So it's going beyond the important term sustainability into regeneration. How do we regenerate our farming in such a way that is actually sustainable, but sustainable plus, and into regeneration? I have a good friend, Tom Newmark, who's chairman of the board of the American Botanical Council, my nonprofit mm-hmm. organization that I've had the opportunity to work with for 30 years. And Tom started a new organization called Carbon Underground, which I think is kind of a cool mm-hmm. name, because it's got two or three different layers of meaning there, if you want to go to the double or triple entendre here. But it's teaching and developing techniques and communicating techniques to farmers on how they can continue to sequester carbon and keep it in the earth rather than releasing it into the atmosphere, and ways to actually increase the carbon content of the soil right. instead of releasing it in the atmosphere and creating, obviously, greenhouse gases and other kinds of environmental problems that are sequela of that kind of problem. So we
know that, in particular, sustainable farming techniques and organic farming are really important features to what you're just describing, mm-hmm. especially in terms of the health of the planet, yeah. and ultimately that also supports nutrient density
right.
and the nutrient activity of plants and herbs that are grown. Yeah. How new do you think that really is in our world? Has the natural products industry consumer fully appreciated that? And what else can we do to increase the awareness of how important this is, not only for an individual's health, but for the health of the planet and the communities we live in?
A good question. I think that the natural food consumer and the natural product consumer, which means not just natural food, but they also buy herbal remedies and dietary supplements, as well as natural cosmetics whenever possible, and try to minimize the intake and exposure to synthetic chemicals in their body, because there's a concern. I mean, the word chemical itself has gotten a bad name in some people. They use the word chemical to mean synthetic,
right.
and it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. I mean, we're all made up of chemicals, natural chemicals. I think that it's unfortunate how people kind of use chemical as a pejorative sometimes, but it's understandable where that came from. But I think the natural food shopper is more aware. Because they're more self-educated and they're more committed to natural diet, natural lifestyle, natural therapies, natural healing as a lifestyle commitment and as a priority in their life. And they see that also that it's not just their own lives that are important and their lives of their family members, but by extension, their entire communities, and the communities in this case going to without boundary to the whole global, the biosphere. And if that means not just all people living on the planet, but all living beings living on this planet. So it's the whole biosphere, is the community that we live in. It's not just the plant, the humans, it's the plants, it's the animals, it's the pollinators that pollinate our plants. So when people hear about colony collapse disorder, this affects all of us because it affects our food supply, etc. You know, we hear about certain animals that are maybe going extinct, or certain plants that are having difficulty in mountaintops and stuff like that, because it's getting warmer by several degrees as the climate heats up, and that affects the vitality and the very existence of numerous medicinal and aromatic plants. You know, at the American Botanical Council, in our peer-reviewed journal Herbalgram in 2009, we had a cover story called How Climate Change Affects the future of medicinal aromatic plants. It was the first time that we know of that anybody had covered this story. There, we've seen lots of stories and concern about climate change.
In 2009.
That's 2009, impressive. 9 years ago, right. Almost 10 years ago, we published an article on, with I think using 14 or 16 different expert sources, informants from different organizations around the world that are monitoring these issues and, you know, and seeing that climate change is affecting how plants are growing, where plants are growing, etc. Right. And then we followed up a few years ago on an interesting story on how some people in China are noticing that some of the tea in China tastes differently than before, which suggests different chemistry. If the taste profile has changed, then that suggests the different dominance or reduction in certain chemicals, which, and then they've done some studies, chemical studies, to say, yes, there's been some changes in the chemistry in some tea. And then the question is tea one of the canaries in the coal mine here? Because if the taste of the tea is changing because of climate change, which is an indicator or a result of the chemistry changing, does that mean the nutritional and or pharmacological benefits of tea might also be changing, either for the better or potentially for the worse? And how does that become another canary in the coal mine or indicator plant for other plants whose nutritional values may go up or down, and or their pharmacological effects may be improved or not? Because as we know, plants utilize secondary plant metabolites, these other chemicals in plants, as ways to deal with various stressors. Right. And sometimes withholding sunlight or withholding water or other nutrients can affect the way a plant's chemistry adapts to its environment, right?
Yeah.
Now, that can be a good thing sometimes, and then agronomics, they can actually modify plant chemistry slightly in certain ways to increase the number of certain chemical compounds that might be useful for certain kinds of extracts, and vice versa. So people have to understand that plant chemistry is not something that's static. It's a dynamic interaction with the environment.
Right. It's interesting, the observation you have and what you're describing is what I would call attention on specialty crops. So you see it in the farming industry, and in the herbal industry, and farming practices are part of that for this discussion anyways, that if you look at where we spend most of our attention and funding in the agricultural system in America, it's on what would be called commodity crops.
Right.
So things like soybeans, wheat, corn, and very little on the specialty crops. Yes, it's the specialty crops that hold, in part, the greatest contribution and impact you can on health because of the nutrient density, and I would also argue the quality of the phytoactives that are available in high nutrient dense plants.
Right.
But at the same time, if you look at the 2014 Farm Act that provided almost $500 billion over about 4 or 5 years, less than 1% of that total amount of money is available for specialty crops.
Right, right.
It really points out the importance of how it's going to be up to industry, is my real point in this.
Right.
It's going to be up to industry and nonprofit association and better education to the consumer and the people interested in health and wellness to understand what these techniques are that'll bring about better nutrient profiles for better healthy living, better lifestyle management.
And hopefully that most of that will be done through organic and regenerative agriculture techniques as opposed to through what they call conventional agriculture, which I think, you know, we see a movement away from that by a lot of people these days because it is not sustainable at the end of the day.
Yeah. And so what's the American Botanical Council doing to help become an advocate and increase the awareness and ultimately take awareness into a criteria for selection?
Well, one of the things that we're doing, it's a strategic new development for us, is that we have partnered with a woman named Anne Armbrecht. Anne holds a PhD in anthropology from Harvard University. And several years ago, she created a website called Sustainable Herbs Project. It's being renamed now Sustainable Herbs Program. She's partnering with the nonprofit American Botanical Council, the organization of which I'm executive director for 30 years now. And we are hosting this site, a sustainable herbs program, in a way to help increase both consumer and industry awareness, and awareness by health professionals, researchers, and everybody on the planet who's interested in botanicals and the source of botanicals as herbal medicines, as teas, as food crops, as they may be, so that people can see what type of sustainable activities are being practiced by companies as they manage their supply chain, going all the way back to the source, whether these items are actually cultivated in a hopefully organic and or a regenerative manner, and or wild harvested in the wild, and what's going on with that herbal material throughout the supply chain, and how is that affecting the people that are actually working in that supply chain, and what are the conditions they're working in, and how are they exposed to agricultural chemicals or not, what's the situation as far as the fairness of the type of wages they're getting, because they have to raise families in developing countries, and they have to deal with health issues and education and all these kind of things. And how is our buying dollar for herbs with various companies, how is that affecting the value chain all the way along? Because that's an important part of sustainability.
Right.
It's not just about the earth. It's not just about the water. It's not just about the air. It's not just about the health of the planet. It's also about the health of the people all the way along the value chain. And part of what we're doing with the Sustainable Herbs Program, which is a free website anybody can access, is to try to show people what's going on with how herbs are sourced, showcase companies that are doing good work in the area of sustainable practices along the value chain, but at the same time inspire other companies to also rise to the call and increase their level of sustainable operations, both at the supply chain level, to the extent that they're involved with their supply chain, but also on the operational level. How are they operating their companies in their warehouse or in their offices? Are they doing the obvious things that every third grader knows, like recycling, right, which in some cases they may not be? Do they have live plants in the lobby and throughout the warehouse and without the office to help generate positive ions for people that are negative ions, whatever, positive atmosphere for everybody? And how are they choosing their packaging and their shipping materials? And are they recyclable? Are they compostable? How can companies improve the way they operate to reduce their carbon footprint, to be more sustainable? And how can consumers also learn to become more sustainable in the way they live, starting at home? How much of them are they composting, if that's possible for them? Are they doing the best that they can to reduce their carbon footprint? But this is something that everybody has to be involved in doing, not just those of us who used to compost 50 years ago in the commune and still do, just because it's seemed like a good lifestyle choice.
What's interesting, your 2009 article was way ahead of its time. So that's just being confirmed and reconfirmed again in more recent studies. And I think it's important, particularly people interested in holistic healthcare, holistic lifestyles, need to connect it down into the source of the products that they buy. Is it being supported by those same industry members that are trying to make a difference?
And there's a lot of companies that are doing a lot of work in this industry, in the natural food industry, as well as the natural products industry that deals with botanical for teas and for dietary supplements. There's a lot of companies doing really good work that are really looking at managing their supply chain, qualifying suppliers, setting certain standards and specifications, not just for the quality of the herb, but how those herbs are processed all along the value chain. There's organizations called Fair Trade and Fair Wild that deal with certifications in various areas like this. And at the end of the day, the plants need us, and we need them. We're in a codependent relationship with plants. Life on Earth doesn't happen without plants. Even people who have a meat-centered diet are still related, because ultimately the food chain goes down to herbivores and that eat plant material. And many of us who are vegetarians have basically cut those out of our food chain and go direct to the plant. But without healthy plants, we can't make it on the earth. And one of the articles, one of the items that was in our 2009 article talked about, with increased global warming going on, for whatever reasons that's happening, man-made contributions to that, and or just maybe the fact that the environment's increasing as well, so there's combination of things going on. But, you know, plants don't have legs and they can't kind of scurry up the mountainside to colder weather. When the temperature starts rising just a few degrees, those plants are at risk because they can't go higher and higher because unless they're able to get their seeds blown further up or they get transported on the hair of certain kind of animals or whatever. So plants become at risk, and there are risks in the situation. And recently an article just came out how plants are in the Arctic, small little bitty short 2 or 3 inch plants are actually several inches longer now, larger because of the higher temperatures in the Arctic. And that's just an indicator that plants around the world are in challenge. So people need to be aware that we're living in a world that's changing. And we need to find ways to work not only sustainably and regeneratively at the industrial commercial level, but as well in our own homes. And it all makes a difference because as above, so below, we're part of a bigger picture, and the health of our entire biosphere depends on each one of us.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Mark. Thanks for your insight. Thanks for becoming a vegetarian 50 years ago and being able to share that story and the difference it makes in healthcare and holistic living. Well, thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
This podcast features the song New Day by Lee Rosevere, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. If you like this podcast, please share with your friends and family. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. We'll see you next time on Holistic Matters, where we're talking about being the you that nature intended.